you have the diminishing value of your share because of the increasing number of people. And then new people who come in, or else a second class of stock, you could call it common stock or whatnot, gets a certain set percentage of what's left of whatever distributions you have after that. I mean, that's somewhere in the middle, so that you guarantee the first body a guaranteed return, and they can go ahead and distribute that out to their kids and whatnot, however they want it, because it always remains preferred stock. And yet, you could still stop everyone from being able to alienate it if you want, because that's the problem that we have that we're talking about with individuals being able to replace themselves with non-natives or people who we don't want to. The other thing, the other question I have, in discussing the elders resolution, was it intended, I know that, and there's no, I don't want to upset anyone, but was the idea of the elders, the body of people who existed in 1971, or the idea of elders as an ongoing thing where we will make it a permanent idea that we always do respect elders today as well in 2000? Because, I mean, if you'll forgive me, there will be some people who become older in 1990 who may not exactly be our idea of traditional kind of elders, but they will be, you know, the very successful corporate folks who have a nice pension. And if we want to make this a permanent distribution system, or if we're talking about a, you know, honoring those people who we thought of as traditional elders who existed at a time because they haven't been able to benefit from the act, because in the first 20 years we haven't made money, and they're going to die before they get anything. Is it an ongoing thing we're talking about, or is that a possibility, I suppose, permanent change in the distribution system?
Well, I think the intention here was that elders will always be with us, and those of you that will grow older will benefit someday, or those of us, I should say, and that we'll always have that our elders with us, and that we'll be able to provide for their needs at some point. Ironically, or I don't know whether it's ironic or not, you know, the benefits of the Land Claims Act really have fallen to only a few. And that few are those of us that are employed by the corporations. The primary economic benefit has been to those that have been employed by the corporations, and it has not fallen to the general native population. And we need to accommodate that or take care of that in some way. So I think the intention here is that the benefits to elders will be a continuing process. Now, actually, to your earlier statement, I just have a question of the ability to create specific classes of stock, and you asked Professor Fessler that question about creating maybe a preferred and a common stock class. I was kind of under the assumption that we would have that power anyway after 1991 if nothing changed, and I perhaps need to be clarified on that.
The main thing I was considering was not when we could do it. I mean, we could do it before if we got special legislation. We could do it after, even without, or you with shareholder approval. My question was, is there some system that exists, no matter what it would take to enact it? What are the variations in between giving everyone an absolute equal right versus what we have right now, which is only one set body has a right? What are the options in between? And then there's a secondary issue we can ask when and how we can do it.
Yes, Dan Fessler?
Sure. You have tremendous latitude under Alaska state law, either existing or as proposed by the in the form of the bill that I have been working on. Your choices are not even restricted to having something called preferred or common stock. You can have 10 classes of common stock if you want. You can have one class of stock and divide it into series, which is a traditional way of recognizing when people came on board. The only thing that is required is that you must define the rights and privileges of the various classes or series of stock within the Articles of Incorporation, and to change the status quo, as we discussed a few minutes ago, that would require amending the articles. But I can't stress again that there are doubtless vexations and a lot of of unpleasant consequences of having to deal with this whole problem within the corporate context, and I certainly sensed that before and I'm getting an enhanced sense now. There are a lot of opportunities that you have to determine your own future, even within the specific corporations themselves, and the articles are how you're going to do that with regard to stock. And all you want to do is just make certain that you have somebody who's drafting those articles, helping you, and what are called the indentures, which is the basic statement as between those shareholders and the corporation of their right, that indenture is a very well drafted and understood document, not just from legalese, but so that it's drafted in a language that people really understand what's happening.
Okay. Just to comment on the points that Bart has been raising are the types of discussions that we went through during our retreats. As you can see, looking at what we've been discussing, you know, as Native people, we want to perhaps have our cake and eat it too, in that we want to be able to engage in some economic activity that would benefit us. Yet we also want to be able to maintain either a tribal identity or some identity that is not dependent upon membership in a corporation. And the dilemma that we have gone through and how do we accommodate that, I think one of the other resolutions kind of addresses that particular dilemma, and that's the last one that allows us to transfer assets. And because of that dilemma, it places, as you stated, on us a tremendous burden of not eliminating the possibilities of us going either way. And it's a difficult situation for us in drafting the type of legislation that we want, not only to satisfy the legal requirements that you're bringing up, but to satisfy the desires of our people, whether they're living in the villages or in the cities.
With respect to the topic again, which just as a technician, I wouldn't dare go near how you want to substantively define who is an elder or whether that is to be a continuing process. I simply point out that at the time, if you decide to go stock classification as a means of accommodating such worthy people, that you have the perfect prerogative to define who is going to be now or in the future entitled to this stock by simply drafting carefully the share indenture and the amendment to the articles. And then that will set in motion either a group of people who are now but not in the future or a group of people who will be perpetuated as they qualify for whatever you set down. You have such tremendous opportunity to resolve these problems internally.
Can we do that now under current state law?
No, but after 1991, if Congress didn't do anything, you would have plenary power to do that. Now, there's the further problem that you made me sensitive to, and that is the concept of getting some of the major issues of corporations, especially among the regional corporations, that they're all sort of similar. And, of course, by saying that a corporation can do this in its articles, I'm also saying that 13 corporations could have radically different approaches to this matter, and whether that is a culturally or politically acceptable concept is something for you to determine, not for a technical lawyer.
Could I ask a question that I think Tony asked, but I didn't... Under Resolution 84... 04, I believe it is, you can issue shares to new natives. Leave the elders out of it for the moment. You can do that without consideration. That is, a corporation could decide by an appropriate majority of its shareholders to issue 100 shares to each child of shareholders who was born after 1971. And what did you say about those shares, that they would only be shares that would be held for life? Did you say that?
No. What we were discussing was the following resolution when I mentioned that. Now, the point could also apply here. that the new shares that are issued would be life estate shares, or whatever you'd call them. That's one of the solutions that's been brought out, and it may not be the solution that is taken, but it's certainly something that I think needs not only more discussion, more research, and perhaps drafting. I don't know that.
Yeah. The idea was, I take it, that the roles would be permanently open, so that after 1991, each child born then would get 100 shares.
That's correct. And there is two ways, I think, that we've discussed doing that. One is this resolution. The other would be the one where we would transfer assets to a related Native organization, a tribe or co-op. And if you're a tribe, an IRA counselor, traditional counselor, or whatever, you're a member by being born a Native. And the intention there was to perpetuate Native control and ownership over the land as well as the assets of the corporation.
Yeah. No, I was just curious how this issuance of shares to new Natives would work. And if you use the corporate thing, corporate structure, you would be issuing theoretically 100 shares to each child as born. The roles would be permanently open, and it would be an incident of ownership of shares in that corporation for the individual shareholder that there would be continuing dilution of the value of his shares, the idea being there would be no compensation for.
Yeah, that's true, unless we went to some solution that, like Tony has mentioned. Now, one of the things that you notice in this is that I think the reason for the shares issuance, it's kind of a matter of semantics, since we're still talking corporate organization here. I mean, we could have easily said membership, and in fact, the last resolution does say membership rather than shares. Benefits to members, where everybody would be issued a life membership. It doesn't say anything about shares.
Gary, and then I think we'll stop after that.
Just a couple of observations with regard to the demographics involved. You know, a fairly substantial proportion of Alaska Natives live in urban areas. And it seems that if you're attaching priorities to the utilization of the land and the maintenance of stock in Native hands, one consideration might be that over a couple of generations, there might be not only dissolution of the stock, but increasing intermarriage between Natives and non-Natives, and that would present problems in itself with regard to the transfer of voting rights and other privileges that belong to shareholders. Another consideration, and I think that this is very controversial, and I don't know the answer to it, is whether or not some of these important issues are going to be resolved in and of themselves through the natural attrition process. In other words, what happens when a person dies? What happens to their stock? In increasing the size of the stock and leaving the assets fixed, you diminish the value. That's very obvious. But in maintaining the number of shares outstanding, but distributing them throughout the family, you increase coverage. At the same time, you maintain the integrity of that corporation's ownership.
Monroe Price?
Yeah, I just want to say that in some way the problem looking at all the resolutions is whether it's correct to have a large, and I mentioned this to Bart yesterday, a large umbrella of options, or whether there should be a narrower set of options. Is this, it seems to me the point of these resolutions was to provide a wide array of options with the question of how they're used in establishing a policy for 1991 being up to each corporation. It seems to me there may be a fundamental question about whether having breadth is a good or bad thing, et cetera. But that really, I think, is the underlying philosophy here. And an effort being made within certain constraints to provide as much flexibility as possible.
Yeah, David Case.
Will you be back this afternoon? Yourself?
No, I won't be. I won't be able to.
Okay. Maybe we don't want to do it now, but would like to explore what you mean by the whether there are advantages or disadvantages to having breadth and not having breadth.
Well, Monroe, you'll be back.
What do you mean by? Well, I didn't understand the question.
Monroe said that these resolutions were designed to give a broad range of options, but suggested that there may be questions about whether giving a broad range of options is a good idea, and that having a narrow range of options might be a good idea. I would be interested in knowing what the question is. What are the considerations if you were choosing between a broad range and a narrow range of options? What do you have in mind?
How czar-like you want to be.
In reaching some unanimity of support for the concepts, we in fact had to broaden the options because of the diversity of the regions and the villages that are involved. And by allowing a broader range of options, we were able to get broader support. And that's the reason for their breadth, not because we wanted to leave it loose. In fact, as I would have preferred to make them much tighter, but we're different in our region than some of the others. So.
Well, look, Marlene. Omitted natives, that's a phrase destined to take its place in the lexicon with afterborns. But thank you, Marlene. I think that we should stop, and if you would allow me on your behalf to thank Charlie Johnson for coming and leading the discussion, we appreciate it, Charlie. And we'll carry on the discussion with Marlene and Glenn this afternoon, and Monroe to be their legal backup, and the Fessler-Johnston duo over here to shoot darts at them. And maybe this afternoon we could just consider for a minute the question of dissenters' rights and the Fifth Amendment to make sure those are not overlooked. And then we could turn to 07 and 08. Those, I think, can be treated together, and that will take up a good deal of our time, but this seems to me to be a useful discussion, and I'd just like to carry on with it. And I hope that, like Claude and Glenn, people from the villages will feel free to participate. Don't let all this high-powered, but at the moment apparently free legal talent overwhelm you. And we'll come back at 1:30, if that's okay. And we'll send you the transcript, Charlie, with the rest of the free legal advice in it.
Thank you.
that was a good discussion, didn't you think?
Good what?
Good discussion this morning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I keep learning from them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
One of the things you continue to focus on is why village corporations are all
there. Yeah. Yeah.
No. I know this is not a good time for you. My name is Josh Carmichael. I teach in the business school at the University of Washington. And I'm up here on a different continent.
Oh.
We got this, but I've heard about this. And I'm going to try to talk to
you. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, why don't we start then? I thought we might this afternoon, before we take a look at the other two resolutions that Charlie left with us, we might just spend a brief minute or two considering the question of dissenters' rights and the Fifth Amendment and what I understand that entails is the proposition that the rights of dissenting shareholders under common law and Alaska state law should be at an end. That is, they would not be entitled to be cashed out even though they didn't wish to go along with some of these measures. And of course there's the related question I think of whether or not diminution in the value of the dissenting shareholders' shares is a taking of property without compensation under the Fifth Amendment. I don't think we need to be detained very long on those questions, but I think we should at least hear something about them. And maybe you could, I could ask Dan Fessler, perhaps Elizabeth, to address the first, and perhaps David Case or Ralph Johnson to address the second. I hope I've made it clear what I'm talking about, and if you could carry on from there, perhaps each of you might say a few words about it.
Well, I think that it would be better if Liz were to make the initial response, because she simply knows a great deal more about native corporations than I do.
Okay.
Okay, my response will be should be perhaps listened to not just from the point of view of a legal perspective, which of course it will definitely betray, but it also springs from a particular fact pattern, which is Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the fact that in an institutional or political sense, that we have two major divisions within the corporation. 63% for restricted stock, 36% for unrestricted stock, and how one as a management group must pay attention to both these. It's hard to say one is more legitimate than the other, okay? They're both coming out of the shareholder group, and to say that you can, that you may or would wish to ignore one-third of your shareholders is not a situation that, or it is not a position that I wish to speak for. In my view, it would be extremely wise to have within the drafts that go to Congress, and I believe it is at the congressional level that the restricted stock issue must be taken care of, that it would be very wise of the Native community to have one of the alternatives in that draft, even if everybody didn't want to go that way, the opportunity for dissenters' rights. The reason I think that would be wise is, one, my legal perspective, which I said would be betrayed in this answer. My legal perspective is this, that in 1971, when the act was passed, the right to have freely alienable stock in 1991 vested. I may be wrong on this, okay, but this is my perspective. And because it vested, in my view, the only way you can deal with that to move toward the continued restriction is to have a combination of the shareholder waiver, and for those shareholders who choose not to waive, that those shareholders would have the opportunity, not that every shareholder would exercise that opportunity by any stretch of the imagination.
Waiving what?
I'm sorry, that would waive their right to have unrestricted stock in 1991. In other words, that you would have a legal event, a vote at a shareholder meeting, where this operative, mandatory, legal event would take place, where shareholders could choose to waive or not to waive. And I will, for purposes of discussion, assume, and also because of the results of the survey, assume that the appropriate number of our shareholders did waive. Those who did not waive then would have the opportunity for dissenters' rights. This is the procedure that I feel make some legal sense. I feel it would cost Bristol Bay something, but I feel that it would be good to pay it, because in the long run, it is my belief that to do that is the most conservative posture I can suggest in order to have the statute ultimately withstand the constitutional challenge. And by that I mean that one of the things that sort of horrifies me is the thought that we could develop a scheme today whereby we said to all of our shareholders, look, we're going to protect you, we're going to have restricted stock, and we're going to do a variety of things with the land, or create potentials for doing a variety of things with the land. And then later, when a well-financed effort came along with good attorneys on the other side, the protection was stripped because the constitutional issues had not been adequately taken care of. Professor Johnson and I have talked about this briefly and may not be of the same mindset on this, but I think that, I do not believe I'm wrong as a matter of law, but so what? Who cares if I'm right or wrong? I will tell you that it is my perspective, and I will also tell you that I think the most conservative way to deal with the constitutional challenge is to protect yourself against it, so that you're in a posture that says, even if the rights were vested in 1971, we have proceeded in a way where we have taken, where we have balanced those rights, where people have waived them, and we balance them in the same way the normal corporate structure does. So what if you prove if they're vested? We have appropriately taken care of them, and people have been compensated, as was the value of the stock. Now that's my legal perspective. But my political perspective within, again, the context only of Bristol Bay Native Corporation is this, that I do not relish the idea of management, frankly, saying to one-third of their shareholders, you can stick it in your ear. I don't care what you want. 63% want something else, on something this vital. I think there need to be, I don't know whether we call them safety valves in a political sense or what we call them, an appropriate listening to a significant segment of your shareholder population. I don't know how to express this very well, but it is my view in Bristol Bay's case that it would be a real mistake to just say, well, all that matters is the 63% that are going one way. That's perhaps a longer answer than you were. It's more than your two-minute answer.
Yeah. Well, no, it was like all your answers, very, very good. But just to make sure I understand what we're talking about, the minority shareholder, your 37% or whatever they are, has certain rights under common law and under Alaska state corporate law to be cashed out if he doesn't go along with the majority. That's the first thing, I think. And the second thing is, well, even if he has no rights under the law, he has certain rights under the Fifth Amendment not to be have his property taken without just compensation.
I believe that in a legal sense, the Fifth Amendment comes into play, and again, there are other attorneys here who can who could correct the statement, but I believe the Fifth Amendment only comes into play if you assume that certain rights are vested. I think that's the pivotal question here, and as I discussed, I'm assuming that the right to have freely alienable stock in 1991 is a vested right, rather right. than an inchoate right. If you got into the inchoate mindset or assumption, you might come out totally different on the Fifth Amendment question. It's like a threshold. Am I saying this right? It's like a threshold question, and I've come out one way, and some other attorneys would come out another way.
Right. Did you want to add anything, Dan?
No. Just again, to put the thing in its broadest possible perspective, the normal idea in a corporation when you take something to the shareholder level is that the majority rules. And if you're in the minority, you either bide your time until there's another opportunity to elect directors, in which case you hope that you'll more persuasively make your point heard and wind up in the majority. And if you have despaired of an ability to do that, then the normal situation is you have the option to sell your stock. Now, when you cut off the option to sell the stock, you begin to make a fundamental challenge to the whole idea of how corporations run. And the idea is, are you now locked into the situation? Well, in Alaska at the present time, there's only one set of circumstances in which the minority finds itself able to demand of the corporation that the corporation unlock the key, give them something in exchange for their shares, and let them go. And that is if the corporation has gone through what we've been describing as an organic change. If there's been a merger or a consolidation, then by statute you must recognize the concept that there are dissenters' rights. The dissenters' rights that are put forth in the statute are very difficult for most people to comprehend, and you have to be very careful as an individual shareholder to preserve them lest you lose them. But the issue that would arise from the most corporate perspective, for I am no scholar of the Constitution of the United States at all, but from the corporate perspective is, would it be wise to recognize that there's going to be a possibility, maybe a probability, of litigation on this issue if you succeed in getting the prohibition on alienability of stock perpetuated so that you cut off the power of people to say, I don't like what's going on and I'll just sell out, please. And then you propose that people are captured and they have no escape. Especially when, and this I think is the point that Liz keeps stressing, if you were to read existing law, although people didn't buy their stock, which may be the point that needs to be developed, although people didn't buy their stock with the expectation that they could alienate it after 1991, The Act said that the restriction on alienation would expire in 1991. And if Congress is competent to change that rule now, are individuals going to be able to assert some status to say, well, fine, you can do that, but at least you owe me compensation for extinguishing the expectation that I had? The weakness of that position, of course, is that you didn't pay in the traditional sense for that expectation.
Ralph Johnson, did you want to...
Obviously, this is not the time for the lawyers here to engage in a fascinating discussion of constitutional law, so I'll limit my comments to some general conclusions. First, as to the division between the legal and the political issues, I quite agree. I can give you and will give you a very brief statement of what I view the constitutional issue. That's quite different than the political issue, and in one sense, I like the idea of setting up a fallback position that dissenters would be compensated. I worry about another aspect of that, and that is the dissenters who wish to continue to live in the same village and who wish to hunt and fish and cut ice and do other things on that land, and having sold their stock, they have essentially lost their right to do so, so that no trespassing signs will go up to those who sold out. And I suspect that in the long term that's going to be either impossible to enforce or cause a very high degree of conflict and dissension in the village community. If somebody wants to sell out and leave, then that's another matter. But that's a political consideration that I think a lot of people here are more infinitely more informed to worry about than I am. But I wish to raise the issue. On the constitutional issue, I guess just having gone through quite a bit of research on the question, I'm convinced that if Congress goes through the right hoops and does the right thing, says the right things, that it can extend the inalienability of the stock, it can return the land to trust status, it can limit the voting rights of the stock, and it can do all of that without the requirement of payment of compensation. It can do that without violating the Just Compensation Clause of the Federal Constitution. Now, just about 2 minutes on that. Cases that are well known in this field of recent vintage, the case involving the Penn Central Railway Station in New York, another case involving a man by the name of Allard who sold eagle feathers in Montana, who was told in overnight that all of his thousands and thousands of dollars worth of eagle feathers were worth nothing the next day. And the Supreme Court said wasn't entitled to compensation. And there more specifically a case decided by the Supreme Court in 1918 that changed the rules of an Indian in the lower 48 who held allotment land. He held allotment land that was free to be sold, and they changed the rules on him and said, but now he has to have the Secretary of Interior's approval to sell his land. Well, that changed the value of his ownership. All those cases, plus if one looks at the plenary power of Congress to deal with Indian affairs, you add all that up, I guess I'm satisfied that Congress can legislate to terminate or change stockholders' rights in 1991 if they wish to do so. Whether that's wise to do so is a different question. But I think that we can start out, at least as far as I am concerned, with the assumption that if Congress wishes to take such action, it can do so. Well, I might add one other thing, and that is that let's assume that Congress decided to use the fallback position and say that they would compensate somebody for let's assume this action were taken in 1987 and the stock would be able to be sold to non-natives in 1991, 4 years later. And you need to know now the difference in value in the stock in 1987 between that case A, where it's saleable to non-natives in 1991, 4 years later, or secondly, where it's not saleable to non-natives or on the market 4 years later. I suspect it's going to be an extremely small difference in value at that point, because there are so many variables that are involved in the value of stock that, for example, who the current management is, what their investment portfolio is, what their record is of investment and management in the past, the price of rice in China, the price of oil in, from Tehran. All those factors get involved in that, and to sort out and identify a particular value that is attributable to the saleability of the stock on the open market 4 years later will be one exceedingly difficult and probably be pretty minimal. But that would satisfy the dissenting stockholders' problem as Elizabeth Johnson raises it.
David Case, I just had one further question of probably Professor Fessler. Am I correct in assuming, and it is an assumption, that dissenters' rights as dissenters' rights are not vested property rights? In other words, is there any constitutional question when a state or the federal government, as it already has in the case of Alaska Natives, eliminates dissenters' rights?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't know of any such case. But again, I want to very carefully underscore that we're now talking about an area in which I have peripheral side vision, and am attempting to work with a memory of a constitutional course that is a distressingly long time ago. And so I would yield to the expertise
of
others.
You're willing to testify.
That's right. I wouldn't want to be asked that big. Okay.
Roland Shanks. Well, I just wanted to throw a couple things in here. I fear to argue with lawyers, and I only argue with law professors with a lot of trepidation. But anyway. There is one parallel that I think might be worth keeping in mind, especially when it comes to whether, in fact, rights vested with shareholders when the act was passed. And that is, in the last few years, we've successfully made the argument in many cases that selection rights were, in fact, a property right, and that to take a selection right from a corporation without due process was in fact condemnation. Probably one of the better examples of that was in the railroad legislation, where Congress said that it was essentially going to extinguish 3E selections on railroad areas. And we successfully fought them on the basis that that was a condemnation of our selection right. And in fact, we had an attorney general's opinion from the state of Alaska that said that. He left the attorney general's office not too long after that, but he's now our lawyer. but anyway, there have been several other cases, a lot smaller and not quite as noteworthy as the 3E determination cases. But
when you say you won that, did it go to court or
no? They pulled the provision out for fear that that they would lose if it went to court, and we let them know that we were very ready to take it to court. So anyhow, that's just one thing that's happened. I think we might want to kind of throw into the back of our minds that we've already seen kind of a tentative right that was given by the act pretty much dealt as a property right. Not only that, but our own corporations have made that argument. I think to turn around and make the opposite argument to some of our shareholders might be a bit awkward. And that kind of brings me to the next point, and that is when dealing with dissenters' rights and going to Congress and asking them to essentially extinguish dissenters' rights, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I don't deal in courts, but I have been known to wander by a legislative hall once in a while. And I think it would be an extremely difficult provision to sell to the U.S. Congress these days, that some potentially significant portion of the shareholders should just be told that they either take it or leave it. I don't think that the U.S. Congress is in the mood to do that kind of thing. And I think that that is a real stumbling block that we need to deal with when we look at these provisions. I do not believe that that politically is going to fly.
Dan Fischler.
Maybe one advantage of having somebody attend a meeting like this who is so obviously an outsider and who has no background at all is that they'll blunder out and say something which perhaps people with better judgment would keep quiet about. But there is one thought, and I would pose the question to Professor Johnson. I assume that at some point it is conceivable that litigation will be mounted that will have as its overt or covert purpose challenging the wisdom and viability of the congressional decision to make corporations the vehicle for the implementation of the Settlement Act. Right? I assume that the Alaska Federation of Natives would want to pick and choose very carefully exactly whether it was going to be in the upwind position when that situation happened. And I don't know whether or not that is particularly the battleground that I would choose on this issue. At some point, the Supreme Court might get asked to decide when Congress decided, after all of the twists and turns of federal Indian policy, and the many sad stories that could be appended to that history, to use the corporation as the vehicle for the Alaska settlement, and then to say that shares were alienable, and indeed the peculiarities were going to be taken off after 20 years, but that involved a congressional decision that after 20 years that the corporation would have served as a vehicle wherein people would have entered the world with these assets and with it, with a machinery in place, and that all prior history about the prerogative of Congress to change its mind and whether individuals have acquired status as opposed to their historic tribes, etc., that all of those things would be caught in jeopardy on the day that that question is posed in that form, and whether we could be very confident of the outcome.
Well, my view is that that we could be confident of the outcome. The Supreme Court in recent years has taken the position, without reference to Indians, but with reference to what they call future anticipatory benefits from a transaction, business benefits that you will get. And I commented on the Allard, who owned this marvelous collection of eagle feathers and was told a few years ago that his feathers were worth nothing. He could look at them, but he couldn't do anything with them because he can't sell them. Well, instantly his inventory went from hundreds of thousands of dollars worth down to zero, and the Supreme Court said, that's too bad, because those are not present benefits. That's something you would have earned in the future. It looks very much like stock ownership in ANCSA. Secondly, if you look at the Menominee termination, the Menominee tribe individually held stock in a state chartered and state organized corporation, and that was, the land was taken out of that status and put back into trust.